I open the Rules Committee, and I want to thank all of you for being here. We're going to, in a moment, open three of the bills or memorials that we have today to begin with, so that people, when they come up to testify, have the opportunity to testify on all three of these, the one we are not. So we will be opening a hearing in a short time from HB 2556, HJM 5, and HR 4. So those will all be open together so that people can give testimony at one time when they come up, so they don't have to come back and forth. And then after we have the hearing on that, we will have a hearing on HJM 7. So people know that that's kind of the order that it's going to be in. And just before we get started and have an explanation of all of them, I guess I want to give the opportunity for the people at the dais to say a couple words, if they wish to, about this series of bills that we're going to be talking about today. And I want to acknowledge two of the members on the committee who requested that we get this early and have this hearing today. One of those is Representative Gelser, and the other is a co-sponsor of one of the bills, Representative Edwards, who kept talking to the chair to make sure that these were going to be heard early in the session so that people could get on the record with regard to these bills. And I just want to acknowledge their efforts behind the scenes to make this all happen. And with that, I just want to make my own personal statement. These are emotional bills, and they are emotional issues that we all talk about. For me, I was the high school principal at Marshfield in Coos Bay, Oregon, and one of my students was a navigator on an airplane that at the very beginning of the Iraq War flew into a mountain after having been on missions. He was in the Marine Corps for many, many different missions back and forth, supplying. It was one of the first losses of life in that war, and so all of the media showed up in Coos Bay, Oregon to cover it. The student, his father was one of my teachers. It was a very difficult time for a lot of us. And I will tell you that knowing the young man and understanding the commitment he had chosen to make, and those of us who understand his particular situation realize that instead of coming home when he could, he let a person who had a family come home, stayed an extra term, and that's when this happened to him. And we know, I know in my heart, that he was doing what he believed to be a very important task and an important thing for his country and for himself, because he'd made that decision. And I think as we go through these hearings, I hope that we can keep it on the level that we really understand the concept here is that we're doing things that we don't approve, we probably shouldn't be doing. That's what you read in these bills. And that's an important amount to come out. What I want to make sure that people truly understand from my perspective is the young men and women who are fighting these battles for us. That was not the commitment they meant when they raised their hand. They said they would do what was asked of them. And I think all of us support the efforts and the hard work of those individuals. And I think that goes, I think, without saying, but I still felt we need to say that we can have discourse. I think that's important. It's really important to have you here to have that public discourse and for us to be open and hearing what's being said. But at the same time, let's keep it to the issues as opposed to those individuals who are doing what they signed up to do, and who I think all of us recognize are putting their lives and on hold in many cases, but they did it because of a commitment they made a long time ago before all of this happened. And we've also, as a teacher, as a principal, with the repeated missions that have gone, I've had a number of teachers that have been called back 2 and 3 times. We know how hard that is on their families and the communities, but in most cases, they do that with the honor and integrity that they signed up to do it, and albeit is awfully difficult, and I don't know. In fact, I'm certain that for me to have made some of those commitments would have been very, very difficult. So I honor their service as we have these conversations. And with that, are there other people who would like to say something on the dais before we get going? Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, in my opinion, some of the bills listed on today's agenda could negatively affect Oregon and members of the Oregon National Guard serving overseas.
Any other? Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to hear these bills today. I know that they're important to many of my constituents. Many of the people in this room today are people that are from my community and my legislative district, so I welcome all of you to this hearing as well. I echo the comments that you made earlier about just my wholehearted support of the women and men who step up and make so many sacrifices for each of us every day, and our need to support them in every way that we possibly can. I think what's interesting about some of these bills, beyond the issue of current events today, I think it raises an interesting legal discussion about the separation of powers between the federal government and the state government and where the lines of authority lie. And I'm very interested, beyond the context of our current events, to pursue that conversation and learn more about that, and appreciate the opportunity to learn more and have that conversation.
Thank you, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do appreciate your willingness to have the hearing on these bills today. And you're right, it's an emotional issue, and for many folks, it's difficult to separate the current mission from the discussion and debate over proper use of the Guard. And I certainly, while I disagree with my good colleague, Representative Garrard's assessment of this discussion, this debate, I absolutely think that we can, from a very patriotic place in our heart and in our mind, challenge what the proper use of the Oregon National Guard is and ought to be, and that's really where I'm coming from. Thank you.
Any other? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I deeply hope we're, as a country, not treading on the slippery slope that will lead us to the chaos that we experienced in the latter portion of the Vietnam years in conflict. I do not wish to make any defense of Vietnam, nor any criticism of anyone, either in our government or other governments, in relationship to that particular time. But I think the actions that took place in this country hurt a lot of people, that were already hurt deeply by the events of Vietnam itself, and then were even hurt worse when they came home. Have some little familiarity with the issues that are at stake with this. Precede in years either of the events now or the ones that have transpired back through Vietnam, but I was on active duty in the Korean conflict, and that was a prelude in some ways to events that took place after Korea into Vietnam, where the reputation of our military and personnel and other things became somewhat questioned in our society. The young men and women, whatever their motives may have been, when they joined the National Guard or when they enlisted in the service, are their motives and I certainly would not want to question them or in any way. I just would hope that, like I say, that this is not a beginning of something that heading down a path that we don't want to go.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. With that, we are going to open a hearing on, or public hearing, on House Bill 2556. It also has an amendment, amendment to House Bill 2556. We aren't having a work session, so we can't move it in, but people who have that amendment could speak to that one as well. I just want to make sure that was clear. We also have H.R. 4 and H.J.M. 5, so open that hearing. And with that, just some protocol things. Generally, we let representatives come up first so that they can get back to other committees that they have to get to. Secondarily, we generally have some people who were the sponsors of the bill, so and they would come up after at the same time or right thereafter if they're not members. To give general ideas about how the bill is written. And then it's kind of opened up. And if there are people who are more than 100 miles away or so, we give them deference if they can't come back. We will continue to listen until everybody gets to have their speak. If we have to, we'll close the time down a little bit. But with that, I will invite Representative Shields. Do you want to come up this time, Representative Richardson as well, and Representative Bailey? And if you would like, well, let's just take the two of you guys first, and then we'll go. And we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I'll go briefly over these three bills, which share a number of factual relevant facts in common. HB 2556 limits the service of Oregon National Guard to the state of Oregon unless called to federal active duty under a constitutionally authorized federal order pursuant to a congressional declaration of war or a valid congressional resolution. It also authorizes the Attorney General to appear in court on behalf of the state if the governor declines to order the organized militia to federal active duty. The National Guard of the United States is a reserve military force composed of state National Guard members or units stationed in each of the 50 states and U.S. territories. The Oregon National Guard operates under the governor of the state of Oregon, and when federalized, serves at the pleasure of the United States President. The National Guard may be called up for active duty by the governor to respond to domestic emergencies and disasters, such as caused by hurricanes, floods, and earthquakes. And since September 2001, more than half of the Oregon National Guard has deployed overseas. In 1986, the U.S. Congress adopted the Montgomery Amendment, a federal law that stripped governors of the right to stop the deployment of state guard units to federal active duty outside of the United States because of any objection to the location, purpose, type, or schedule of such activity. That amendment was enacted by Congress and signed by the President after the governors of California, Maine, and Ohio refused National Guard deployments to Central America. The Montgomery Amendment was subsequently upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. ORS 396.135, which is the subject of Measure HB 2556, currently provides that the governor shall order out for service the organized militia when the militia of the state is called forth under the Constitution and laws of the United States. HB 2556 places some limits on that. HJM 5 urges Congress to enact legislation that restores powers of state governors to withhold consent to federalization of their federal National Guard units. Provides exception in cases where a declaration of war has been adopted or the United States faces attack or invasion and the President has invoked powers authorized by Congress to address those circumstances. Proponents assert with regard to this measure, one, that the War Powers Act of 1973 limits the powers of the President to wage war without the approval of Congress, two, that there is no authority under the Constitution or the laws of the United States for the continued presence of Oregon National Guard members in Iraq and Afghanistan, specifically other than the several authorizations for the use of military force enacted by Congress in 2001 and 2003, and three, that those authorizations are overly broad and lack either a termination date or process or procedure to determine when the authorizations should terminate. H.R. 4 urges the governor to withhold the deployment of Oregon National Guard forces to Iraq or Afghanistan. the proponents with regard to that, a certain addition to the 3 points I made with regard to HJM 5, the fourth point that the president is required to order troop withdrawal within a reasonable time, but has taken no such action as of the date HR 4 was drafted. Based on the foregoing, HR 4 would urge the governor to withhold deployment of the Oregon National Guard to Iraq and Afghanistan. That's my summary.
Thank you very much. And with that, testimony from our two witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip.
Pull that mic. I don't know if they can hear you in the back if you don't get it closer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent District 43 in the Oregon House of Representatives, Inner North and Northeast Portland. And I'm here in support as one of the chief co-sponsors of House Bill 2556. I also am one of the co-chairs of the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means, where we oversee the military department's budget, the National Guard's budget. This bill calls the question on what I think is the most important issue of our time, which is under what circumstances do we go to war, and what's the proper role of the National Guard, and under what circumstances are they federalized? I married into a strong military family, and that military family has certainly informed my views on this topic and this bill. The purpose, as I see it, and a lot of people will have different views of why this bill is important, and I think you could have multiple views depending on your perspective, but from my view, a couple of things are important. We've been in Iraq since 2003, and if going back to Representative Jensen's views or comments about Vietnam, it was at least, 6 years after President Nixon took over and promised us a secret plan to get out of Vietnam that we actually did so. And so what my concern is that without some pressure that the President and Congress might not redeploy as promised out of Iraq and hopefully out of Afghanistan as quickly. And I would hate to see our continuing occupations go from 16 months, which many people believe is a very, very difficult timeline to hit, to 2 years, to 3 years, to 6 years, to 8 years. And I think it calls the question, it's not so much a question of whether or not we believe in this war. We're asking the governor to make an opinion about that, his views on this war and this deployment. But it simply calls the question, is the authority through which they have been sent into these occupations valid? And has the congressional resolutions been in line with the United States Constitution? And that's the question that we believe this bill calls. Now, some people have had some concerns about the constitutionality of this question. I think that's a fair criticism, but I ask you, if you ask three lawyers whether or not something's constitutional, they'll say, it depends. It depends on when it gets to court. It depends on the court that it goes before. It depends on precedent. It depends on the interpretation of the law in that given moment. So what I would suggest is that we go forward, we pass this bill as amended with the Dash 1 amendments, which I'll leave to Representative Richardson to discuss as kind of a negotiated improvement to the bill and to move forward. In closing, I just wanted to say that as chair of the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means, I've worked closely with Director Willis of the Veterans Affairs Department to call attention to Gulf War Syndrome and the effects of depleted uranium on our troops. I've been a very strong supporter of the reintegration program. We've helped to highlight in our committee our troops' exposure to hexavalent chromium, a toxin that our troops were exposed to thanks to, in my view, in the allegations in a lawsuit, the malfeasance of KBR Incorporated. I played a part in the creation of a vet center at Portland State University with Sergeant Benjamin Hare and Jacob Meek. was helpful in creating the National Association of Black Veterans here in Oregon, getting them status in the federal building to serve vets, been a donor to the Veterans Scholarship Fund at PSU, and a supporter of returningveterans.org, which is a group that provides mental health counseling to troops who have combat stress and post-traumatic stress disorder. And I say that just simply to underline that no matter how we feel about these wars and these occupations, and I'm very sincere when I say the statement, no matter how we feel about that, we all support our troops. This is not about the next deployment. It's about calling the bigger question for now and the future on how we go into war and what's the proper role for our National Guard. So, again, I would encourage you to eventually take the Dash 1 amendments and consider moving this bill forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll go to both before we have questions.
Thank
and you,
you.
Might want to move that one closer because the mic's not
Mr. picking. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Richardson. I'm state representative for District 4, which is southern Oregon between western Medford and Jackson County across into Josephine County. And I'm here to discuss with you the provisions for House Bill 2556-1 with the Dash 1 amendments. I and Representative Shields have discussed the wording of the bill, and if assuming that the amendments are to be adopted, then I fully am supportive of it. And the reason is what we have here is a basic question of the equilibrium of constitutional law. The Oregon Constitution specifically states that the Legislative Assembly shall provide by law for the organization, maintenance, and discipline of a state militia for the defense and protection of the state. And then that's in Article 10, Section 1. Section 3 goes on to say that the governor is the commander-in-chief of the military forces for the state. Now, at a federal level, this ancient and accepted provision that the National Guard and the Air Guard are essentially our organized militia, that it, in a sense, has become an additional branch of the military through a failure by the federal government to accept the division of federalism, the division between state and federal government. For instance, in 2007, the John Warner Defense Authorization Act was passed, and this act stated that the governor of a state is no longer the sole commander-in-chief of their state's National Guard during emergencies within the state. And it goes on to say that the President of the United States will now be able to take control of the state's National Guard units without the governor's consent. Now, in 2008, because all 50 governors were quite adamantly opposed to that 2007 act, there was a change. Some of its provisions were repealed, but those that continued allows the President to call up the National Guard of the United States to active federal military service during congressionally sanctioned national emergency or war. That is more in harmony with the U.S. Constitution, which talks about the militia, the organized militia, being able to be called up in times of emergency or insurrection or invasion. But that is no longer the case. And to be in conjunction and in harmony with the original intent of our Constitution, both federally and the state Constitution, we have proposed the Dash 1 amendments to 2556. These amendments are quite short. It boils the bill down to this provision. First, it identifies the organized militia as the Oregon Air National Guard and the Army National Guard. And then it states, the organized militia is limited to service on behalf of the state of Oregon unless the organized militia is called into federal service pursuant to a valid congressional enactment consistent with the United States Constitution. That's all it says. It is a reiteration, a reaffirmation, that we as a state honor the role of our organized militia to be in harmony with the U.S. Constitution, and that the mere fact that a stronger, ever-growing power in the executive branch at the federal level may have taken it upon itself to utilize our National Guards in all the states as if it were an additional regular Army branch of the military, that
is wrong, and it's unconstitutional, and it violates both of our constitutions under which we as representatives have sworn to honor and maintain. And this bill merely sets forth that it's Oregon's intention that we honor the Constitution and that our armed forces, the National Guard and the Air National Guard, may be called up when subject to a valid resolution by the Congress. And so I would ask that the Dash 1 amendments be accepted, and that by doing so, then we will have a bill that is appropriate because it merely restates what we've all sworn to do, and that is to uphold our Constitution. Thank you.
Any questions for either of these people? Representative Jensen.
Yes. good afternoon. Representative Richardson, you were making some statements about it is unconstitutional. But what is unconstitutional is not really unconstitutional until an appropriate forum, i.e. a court, that has jurisdiction, so declares or so rules. Isn't that right?
That is correct. In fact, in a recent case, I think it was 1992, not too recent, but fairly recent.
That's recent.
The state of New York was put into a position where the federal government was saying to them that they were going to assume responsibility for nuclear waste that was placed in their state, and they resisted it and said, now, wait a second, that is beyond what the federal government's power is to do, you know, to enforce upon a state. And so they went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and in that instance, the Supreme Court said, you know, the 10th Amendment is still alive, that the states are not branches of the federal government, and what we're proposing with this bill is to say that also applies in issues relating to our National Guard. They are the state militia, not a regular branch of the military. All this bill does is state that we want to live under the terms of the Constitution and remind the executive branch of the federal government that they also need to honor the terms of the Constitution.
Follow?
Yes.
But even if we pass this bill, the behavior really wouldn't be unconstitutional until we took it to the United States Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court declared it such.
Absolutely correct, okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Jensen. It's not the intention of this bill that this be any kind of a declaration other than a reminder that we believe that our Guard should be called pursuant to congressional resolution under the terms of the Constitution. And then it is also a reminder to our governor that the legislative body, if this is passed, is reminding him to maybe join with other governors and discuss with our congressional representatives the need to transition back to a more constitutionally based utilization of armed forces from the state militia.
Thank you. It was the last statement that I'm sorry I made the question, two-pronged question, had to ask two questions to get you to make the last statement, that which is the one I think that's important to the discussion here.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Richardson, you and I understand your commitment to the military, that you're a Vietnam vet, helicopter pilot, and a great patriot. In your amendment, is it your opinion that the current deployment of our National Guard is pursuant to a valid congressional enactment consistent with the United States Constitution, or not pursuant to a valid congressional enactment consistent with the United States Constitution?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I do not feel qualified to give an opinion on the validity of the congressional resolution that is the basis for the deployment that's about to take place. I can say this, that the situation that we're in with the federal government utilizing National Guard troops for repeated deployments to foreign lands when there's no longer an emergency is something that is going to have to be taken up at the federal level and maybe at the Supreme Court level. I believe that because it took decades to get to where we're at, it's not going to change overnight, nor should it, that we have to make sure that our military functions in a rational and logical and sequential manner, and that any change that shifts us back to a more fundamental constitutional provision needs to take place at the highest level of federal government, and that there needs to be a shift, a change in strategy, not merely a position taken by individual states that they're going to change overnight. And I guess what I'm saying is that we have to make sure that we do nothing that will go beyond what patriotic supporters of the United States of America want to do. And so I believe that this is just a first step in the process for the federal government to change the way that they're deploying state troops in the future.
I'm not sure if you answered my question or not, but thank you.
Any other questions for these witnesses? Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bailey, Representative Maurer.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Representative Ron Maurer, serving House District 3, which is most of Josephine County. My presence here and my comments are not about the merits of each bill, resolution, or memorial you are debating, but to sit here before you today as a representative of the many men and women who are not permitted to speak. The soldier's voice is silenced by the structure in which they have committed their lives through an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America and to be led by those duly appointed over them. The sun has set in my 21 years of duty as a regular Army officer and member of the United States Army Reserve, and there is not a single day I regret. Whether I was in the frozen interior of Alaska or on a small island on the Indonesian archipelago, I volunteered for the honor to serve and perform my duty without question, without reservation. I wore the uniform to give orders to the soldiers under my leadership and to carry out those orders of those commanders over me. Soldiers are not afforded the luxury to question the merits of their orders and understand that the mission they are tasked with takes precedence over personal comforts foregone and hardships endured. In your deliberations about the consequences of these matters, it is imperative that you remember that soldier who voluntarily committed to serve the greater good. If you want to hear their stories, then you must demand that they be permitted to express their views about what they believe the role of the Oregon National Guard is. It is easy for those who have never worn the uniform to criticize and question the role and duties they so embark. It is my fervent hope that you honor their devotion to duty and commitment to mission accomplishment, which affords you the continued ability to peaceably assemble in a democracy and question their role. I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Some powerful words to remember and to follow after. My name is Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing Inner East Side Portland. I also have the honor of representing one of the few places that still receives daily delivery of the Oregonian. And read today in the paper, in the editorial section, that an opinion that we might be sending mixed messages. So I want to be very clear about the message that we're sending. We support our troops. We honor our troops. Our troops are doing exactly what you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Maurer have said. They're doing what we ask of them. This bill is not about active service military or a referendum on the particular conflicts. This bill is about protecting those who are protecting us in the National Guard. And sometimes when they do what we ask of them, they are doing what the federal government asks of them, and sometimes they are doing what the state of Oregon asks of them. And what this bill does is allows for a determination, these bills do, is allows for a determination to be made about which is which. These are troops that have served with distinction and have made their country proud. We honor their sacrifice. Whether that sacrifice is abroad or whether that sacrifice is here at home, filling sandbags, fighting fires, or being good fathers and mothers. We also honor the sacrifice of their families. These are men and women who have a role to play at home. These are not weekend warriors. These are people who have been sent abroad again and again. and whether that was the mission for which they signed up or whether it was not. We want to make sure that the state of Oregon is able to act under the United States Constitution, honor the United States Constitution, uphold the United States Constitution, and make a determination about the use of our National Guard soldiers. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Again, thank you both for being here. I don't see any other representatives, so we're going to go to our list, and thankfully on the list there was no one who was more than 100 miles away, so we get to just go down the list. So we're going to bring up six people. There's only three seats, so I guess they'll have to sit a little behind, and they can go in the order. Steve Goldberg, Leah Bolger, Todd Barnhart, Tara Pritchard, and Benji Lewis. And Paula Rue, I think, is also part of that group. So however you want to organize yourselves, I am... And please, another thing I had forgot to mention. One of our other protocols is that you identify yourself for the record before you speak so that it goes on our electronic taping mechanism. So with that, and these mics don't pick up as well as some of the other committee rooms. Thank you.
My name is Stephen Goldberg. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland and a member of a group called the National Lawyers Guild. The primary purpose of my testimony is to address concerns which have been raised that House Bill 2556 is unconstitutional because it violates the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution. I guess I'm one of the three lawyers Representative Shields talked about today. But I don't think the issue is that unclear. So my written testimony and the testimony that's being submitted of Mr. Scotch address this issue in more detail. The major problem with this objection, I believe, is that it misconstrues what the bill does. Now, historically, the state's National Guard could only be activated by the federal government with the consent of the state's governor. In the mid-1990s, several governors objected to their state's guards being activated and being sent to Latin America for training missions. And the governors objected to what the United States at that time was trying to do in Latin America and to the purpose of the activation. And Congress responded in 1986 by passing what you've heard before. It's called the Montgomery Amendment, which prohibits a governor from withholding consent to activation based on an objection to, and this is from that bill, the location, purpose, type, or schedule of such active duty. Now, it's important to be clear about what the governors were doing. They were not saying that there was anything illegal or invalid about this activation in the mid-1980s. They were objecting to its purpose and its location. And the legislation prohibited such interference, and the amendment was upheld in a 1990 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, what HB 2556 does not do is allow the governor to do anything prohibited by the Montgomery Amendment. And that's what's, I think, really critical to understand. If a governor of this state objected to young men and women in the Oregon National Guard being called to active duty and sent to Iraq because the governor objected to troops serving in Iraq, or objected to the purpose of the mission, that is clearly prohibited by the Montgomery Amendments. The governor couldn't do that. But if the governor determines that the authority underlying the activation, I think the question that you came to, Representative Berger, in your question, that the authority underlying the activation is invalid, so using the language of the bill, if that authority is not based on a constitutionally authorized federal order pursuant to a congressional declaration of war or a valid congressional resolution, then the governor has every right and indeed has a duty as the state's chief executive to refuse to comply with that activation. Now, in that situation, the governor is not objecting to the location of the call to active duty. He or she is not objecting to the purpose or the type or the schedule of the activation. He is instead objecting to the power of the Secretary of Defense to call Oregon troops to federal active duty when Congress has not authorized the use of force or where the expressed purpose of Congress's prior authorization has been satisfied. In that situation, it's my position that the governor is not contravening the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution. In fact, he is essentially upholding the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll have the whole group going in. Yep. Questions? Next.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the House Rules Committee. My name is Leah Bolger. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2556 as amended and House Resolution 4, and my remarks will also speak to House Joint Memorial 5. My name is Leah Bolger. I retired from the United States Navy as a commander in the year 2000 after 20 years of active duty service. I founded the Corvallis chapter of Veterans for Peace and served as its president for 3 years. In January 2009, I was elected as the National Vice President of Veterans for Peace and represent VFP on the National Steering Committee for the Bring the Guard Home campaign. I have also been heavily involved in our state's version of this campaign, which is called Keep Oregon's Guard in Oregon. I'm here today to testify in strong support of HB 2556 and HR 4. I believe that you are already convinced that our Guard should not be going back to Iraq. You already understand the cost. And even if you supported the invasion and occupation of Iraq in the beginning, even if you support our continued military presence in Iraq today, you don't believe that it's the job of the Oregon National Guard to be that presence. The crux of H.R. 4 is that the authorizations for the use of military force passed by Congress in 2001 and 2002 are no longer valid. The 2001 AUMF, passed just 1 week after the 9/11 terror attack, launched the Global War on Terror, an open-ended authorization which gave the president carte blanche to use military force to counter not an enemy, but an idea anywhere in the world in perpetuity. The modern-day National Guard is not intended to be a frontline combat force in aggressive wars of choice for indefinite periods of time. There currently exists no emergency which would warrant their federalization, nor any legal authority which would mandate it. The 2002 AUMF had two specific missions: to counter the Saddam Hussein regime, which our country considered an imminent threat, and to hunt for the weapons of mass destruction. Those missions, even if they were valid at the time, are certainly moot at this point. Even the public affairs officer for the Oregon National Guard, Major Michael Brabish, agrees. During a radio talk show on February 3, 2009, he agreed with me that, quote, indeed, the AUMF has expired. Passage of H.R. 4 would urge the governor to withhold deployment to Iraq for this very reason. In my work to promote this legislation, I have spoken with state legislators who told me they believe, or they were told, that this legislation is unconstitutional. I say, with all due respect, that is not for them to decide. We have shown that there are legal arguments to be made on both sides of this issue. The courts should decide who is correct. I want to counter another argument I have heard, which is that since the federal government provides almost all the funding for the Guard, they have the right to use it whenever and however they want. And that if our governor doesn't give them up, the federal government will cut off our funding. This argument has no validity. The federal government is required by law to fund the National Guard. There is no person or office that has the power to cut off the funding in this way. I have also been told by some legislators that they do not support our occupation of Iraq. They agree that our Guard has been misused and should not be sent back, and that the state of Oregon has already paid a dear price in this conflict. Then in the next breath, they say that their hands are tied and there's nothing they can do. Frankly, This is an insult to the guardsmen, their families, and the thousands of citizens who have worked so hard to show you that there is something you can do. We have identified a legal avenue for you, and although it may not be the easiest path, if you don't take it, I want you to ask yourself if you have done everything within your power to stop this illegal deployment of our National Guard troops. Ask yourself how you are going to face the next National Guardsman's widow or parent if you don't try. As far as HJM 5 goes, this measure would call on Congress to reassess the governor's authority to withhold authorization of his state's guard for the purposes of purpose, location, type, and schedule. While our campaign is not opposed to that idea, HJM 5 does not address our concerns and is not an acceptable substitute. The measures we support, House Bill 2556, as amended, and H.R. 4, are not the product of some far-out peace activists. They are not radical or extreme. In fact, we in the campaign believe that they're not really even necessary. We believe that the governor could stand up today and challenge this federal call-up. But we also understand that no governor is going to go out on that limb without the support of the legislature and the people. We believe the passage of HB 2556 and HR 4 will give the governor the support he needs to act, to step out of his comfort zone, and to make the best decision for the people of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Tara Puckett, and this is Nicholas Puckett, and we're here today. He's here with me today because my family every day is dealing with the effects of my husband's traumatic brain injury and PTSD. And this morning, it was really very clear to me that it was not safe for me to leave my husband with our son. My husband, Brian, is a member of the Oregon National Guard in Corvallis. We have six children, ages 10 months to 18 years. And I'm here today to ask you to vote in support of House Bill 2556 and House Resolution 4. Brian was deployed to Iraq with the National Guard for 15 months in 2006 and 2007. When he got the orders for that deployment in January 2006, we were in the process of moving to Corvallis from Kenosha, Wisconsin. We were at that point legally unable to move out of state. But our boxes were all packed, our moving truck was due to arrive the next day, and new tenants were set to move into the house we were vacating. We had to postpone our plans and put almost everything we owned in storage. We had nowhere to live, so for several months our family stayed in hotels and with relatives. Our children went to three different schools that year. We decided that for the sake of stability, the children and I should resume our plans to relocate and try to get settled in Corvallis. And we made it through 13 months of the deployment, and then Brian was wounded in a roadside bomb explosion. He sustained injuries to his leg, his shoulder, and his brain, and suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder. For several days after he was wounded, we were unable to receive updates on his condition or even his location. National Guard families don't live on military bases. We don't have easy access to some of the benefits that we're entitled to when our Guard member is ordered to active duty. We're not always close to the resources and support that active duty families have during extended deployments. We're not surrounded by other families dealing with the same issues. Day to day, and even more when something goes wrong, we're very much on our own in ways active duty families are not. Brian has served in the National Guard since March of 2001. He is currently on stop-loss orders until the end of 2010. He once planned to remain in the National Guard until retirement. Before his Iraq deployment, he looked forward to drill weekends, and he volunteered for extra duty and in-state special assignments whenever they were available. Now that he's damaged in body and mind, his drill weekends are a source of extreme stress to our family, and he hopes to be medically retired as soon as possible. Oregon is about to place several thousand Guard members and their families into situations that could end up like ours. There's a good chance that some of the deploying National Guard soldiers will come home with injuries as bad or worse than Brian's, and some might not come home at all. Our state is voluntarily giving away the great resource of these Guard members who will be in Iraq instead of here if we need them. This deployment increases the possibility that some of these Guard members will return unable or unwilling to continue to serve the state of Oregon at all. Please vote to pass House Bill 2556 and House Resolution 4 and urge the governor to stop this deployment.
Thank you very much. And he's actually being very good. So.
Would it be okay if I take him out at this point?
Sure. Yep. Todd Barnhart and Benji Lewis and Paul LaRue, I think, were the next three.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Todd Barnhart. I'm from Portland, and I'm here today with the campaign to keep Oregon's Guard home, military families speak out, and as a citizen. Thank you for providing this opportunity for me to speak before the committee and to ask you and the Oregon legislature to show unconditional support for the men and women of the Oregon National Guard by passing and acting upon HB 2556 and HR 4. I come before you today in my two most important roles, citizen and parent. Both roles have the same goal, to tell you that in no uncertain terms that the scheduled deployment of the Oregon National Guard must be stopped. As a citizen of this state, one who has served his country in uniform and one who continues to serve through civic and political involvement, I have learned over the years what it means to serve one's nation. When I joined the Air Force out of high school, I had a little idea of what commitment to service meant. Nothing has taught me that lesson more thoroughly than my other role, the one that has transformed my life since the first moment I held my first son as a parent. As a citizen, nothing matters more than the law. You've heard from legal experts on this matter, and you'll hear from more. Here's what I believe about the legality of HB 2556. The legislature's job is not to predetermine what a court might decide if a law is challenged. The legislature's job is to pass the right law. In this case, the right law is the one that protects Oregonians and honors the commitment our state has made to the men and women of our National Guard. The right law is House Bill 2556. And here's why House Bill 2556 is the right law, the law that must be passed by this legislature and signed by the governor. 2556 is a tangible demonstration of our commitment to our fellow citizens, telling them that we respect and honor and love the members of Oregon's National Guard to sit by idly while their bravery and commitment to duty is given to a war we believe to be unlawful and improper. House Bill 2556, in conjunction with H.R. 4 and S.R. 1, is our state's demand that our Guard be called to war only when a constitutional authorization exists for that service. I do not believe such an authorization is in effect, and therefore, the deployment of my son's guard unit is not justified under law. Both of my sons wear their nation's uniform today. Jesse, my younger son, is on his way to seize off Central America on his first Coast Guard assignment aboard the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Midget. Alex, his older brother, is weeks away from deployment to Iraq. I will be honest with you, I did not agree with his decision to join the National Guard while our nation was involved in a war I felt was morally unjustified. But Alex is a strong, intelligent young man, and this is a choice he made, to serve Oregon in her home guard. As his father, I made my choice to insist that his service be what National Guard service historically has been, protecting Oregon in Oregon. I'm here asking your support to these measures because my son is too precious for a war, as President Obama said, that never should have been authorized and should never have been fought. Alex's life is too precious for a cause so unworthy. HR 4 and SR 1 demonstrate that American forces no longer serve a legitimate aim in Iraq. There is no enemy, and there are no weapons that threaten our nation, as the authorization of 2002 falsely but legally declared. There is only a nation we occupy at the cost of more American lives. I cannot bear the thought that my son might possibly be one of those lives. Please give your vote to House Bill 2556 and H.R. 4. Do not worry what the courts may or may not do or what the governor is likely to do. You must do the right thing for my son, for those who served with him in the Guard, and for all their friends, families, and loved ones. You have been sent to this Capitol on behalf of our fellow citizens, on behalf of parents like me. My son's willingness to serve must be honored with a commitment from you that that service will be in a just and legal cause. The deployment to Iraq is neither. Your vote for these measures will send a message to our state, our country, and the world that we in Oregon will back our Guard fighting for a just and legal cause and nothing less. Thank you again for this opportunity.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Benji Lewis. Good afternoon. From 2003 to 2007, I was enlisted in the United States Marine Corps. I regrettably participated in the evil siege of Fallujah and worked with the Iraqi police in Haditha. I'm here today to testify as an Iraq veteran in favor of HB 2556 and H.R. 4. An argument I have heard in favor of the Guard deployment is that the Oregon National Guard has worked so hard that they deserve a chance to prove themselves. If we are patriotic and support our troops, then we must allow them to march to war in some sort of an effort to not send them the wrong message. This argument, however, does not stand up to scrutiny. It goes without saying that the Guard is capable, efficient, and effective. With this knowledge alone, we can see that the above argument is misleading. They have nothing to prove that they haven't proved already. What sort of short-sightedness would produce in us such an argument? We think that because the Guard is trained to go to war, then they must go to war. Perhaps the new residual force does not apply war to some, but I will tell you as a vet that to the men and women on convoy duty, away from home and alone, every second to them is war. A war for survival. Every overpass carries with it the threat of death. Every trash can becomes a fear of explosion. Every hour, organs work overtime to deliver in 110 plus Fahrenheit with more than 50 pounds of equipment on. Every person becomes an enemy. And all of this follows them home and stays with them for the rest of their lives, physically and mentally. Do we say that because they can do this, they must do this? This argument is incorrect, as we would use it in order to plant a false sense of obligation in the souls of our guardsmen and women, our neighbors, in which they must go to war in order to feed their families, to go to college, to get a leg up in order to contribute to society. Still, they will be a step behind, for they, if not tried already by physical wounds, will inevitably suffer from PTSD, and all the benefits in the world will not make life any easier for them. That stigma alone will haunt their ability to get a job, make it difficult to show up to class, and will impact their families at great cost to our society. And all this only if they escape the astonishing figures of veteran suicides, homelessness, and disability. We ask this of our neighbors. What sort of Oregonians are we? We know that the authorization for the use of military force has ended. And if we recollect, we also know that it was a sham. It was a call to war. We know that the WMDs were not there, that we made connections between Al-Qaeda and Iraqis based on racism and false information. But even if these authorizations were justified at the time, they certainly are not now, which makes the argument for deploying the Guard just that much worse. This is a point of H.R. 4, that there is no longer a valid authorization for the call-up. Therefore, we urge the governor to challenge it. In the last administration, we have seen how in a presidential democracy like our own, a regime who won less than half the votes seized all the power and paralyzed all opposition as it bent on achieving its own ends. Federalism was created for the sole purpose of decentralizing power to counteract that threat. With HB 2556, the governor will have the power to be an effective check against those who wish war for their own interests without regard to the interests of Oregonians. It is in the communal interests of Oregonians that I implore you to pass HB 2556 and H.R. 4. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Paul LaRue. I'm a retired United Methodist minister living in West Salem in Vicki Berger's district. And I come to have a think about the moral and spiritual dimensions of what we're talking about today. In scripture sacred to three major world religions, we read, God created man in his own image. people of faith, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, and other world religions believe that all life is sacred. This is as basic as our Declaration of Independence, saying that all people are created equal. Belief in the sacredness of human life leads people of faith to oppose war, or at least to insist that calls to war be justified by the strictest of standards. Unfortunately, extremists in many religions ignore these standards. Some Muslims cry death to the infidels. Some Zionist Jews say God gave this land to us and everyone else must leave or die. Some Christians, from the 12th century Crusaders to our own time, believe that we are the chosen people and God doesn't particularly care for anybody else. Governments get people involved in wars by propaganda that dehumanizes the enemy. In my young adult years, it was the dirty Japs that we were taught to fear and hate and fight against. The writers of South Pacific phrased it this way: you've got to be taught before it's too late to hate all the people your relatives hate. Contrast that with a popular Sunday school song, Jesus loves the little children, all the children of the world. Part of my moral opposition to today's wars is that our young men and women in military training are taught to forget tolerance like that because, quote, our enemies are evil, because they are subhuman beings who must be killed. My faith tells me that what we are doing to people made in the image of the divine is devastatingly wrong. We have killed hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq who had nothing at all to do with 9/11. We have destroyed their economy and made refugees out of a million who survived the war. But we have also damaged the moral fiber of our nation and caused immeasurable damage to our National Guard soldiers, not just those who have died or suffer lasting physical handicaps. I was touched, I'm sure you were, by the things that Ryan's family said and the things that Benji said. We have taught our young men and women to fear and hate. Many have come home so traumatized by what they have seen and by what they themselves have done to other human beings that their very souls are warped forever. They have difficulty returning to the families they had to leave, sometimes leading to abuse or divorce. Many have problems living in society and have irrational outbursts of anger. Some resort to drugs, some to suicide. All this damage, away and at home, is wrong. It is justified by some as the price of defending America. But who says that God wants an American empire to rule the world? As one person of faith, I appeal to you on this committee to keep our National Guard from being sent again to fight an immoral war. I believe that HB 2556 and HR 4 can help with this. I close with a 12th century prayer that is needed so much in our 21st century. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is darkness, let me sow light. And where there is sadness, joy. May the divine spirit guide you each in your responsibilities as representatives of the people of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? No? Thanks to all the witnesses. Next, we have Peter, I think it's Bengal, Kathy Beckwith, and Dan Handerman. Wants to start, Kathy?
I am Kathy Beckwith, Oregonian by birth and by choice and with gratitude. I am a mother, homemaker, trainer of students in conflict resolution, writer, and bookkeeper, among other things. I come to encourage your careful consideration and the passage of HB 2556. I wish to speak to the process that you will use in considering this resolution. I have recently been studying America's wars throughout our history as a nation. What I am finding is startling to me. One who held the vague feeling that, except for a few glitches perhaps, our wars were conducted because those in leadership believed we had to protect and defend the lives and freedom of Americans and others, and that war was their last and only option available. What I read again and again was that war came because of economics, the desire for expansion and conquest of resources, the decision to support or undermine the leaders of other countries because of how their policies impacted our wealth or the wealth of Americans living in those countries, and the belief that all of this was not only our right, but our God-given destiny. It was a disturbing history. I believe that this history of war makes it imperative that those deciding on the fate of this bill never take for granted that the United States government or leadership acted correctly, morally, or legally in attacking Iraq, and that you pledge to hear carefully the background which challenges the authority cited as justification for this war, and thus for requiring the participation of the Oregon National Guard. Secondly, I encourage you to consider the role you personally will play as a decider. I challenge you to find the courage to act against the flow of the current and stop a wrong should you come to believe that a wrong is at hand. I learned more in my history search. 3 years after the Boston Massacre, John Adams reflected in his diary on what had happened in its aftermath. No lawyers in Boston would dare take on the defense of British Captain Preston and the British soldiers who fired into the angry crowd pressing in on them that day. It would be too big a blunder, career-wise, to get involved. Public opinion was strong and certainly not on the side of the British stationed in Boston. The lawyers could not risk rocking their personal boats of well-being. But John Adams got a desperate request from Preston. Help. He decided he must take the case, for he saw the likelihood that justice would be overlooked at best and trampled at worst. And he believed in justice for all. He realized the personal folly in taking this case. His wife burst into tears on hearing his decision, yet said she would set aside her fear for them and their children and trust because she believed his action was right. 3 full years after the trial, he reflected and recognized that suspicions and prejudices against him would probably be remembered as long as this history was read. Yet he also described what he had done as, and I quote from his diary, one of the most gallant, generous, manly, and disinterested actions of my whole life, and one of the best pieces of service I ever rendered my country. Judgment of death against those soldiers would have been as foul a stain upon this country as the executions of the Quakers or witches anciently. I propose to you here that to lift away a judgment of death from our soldiers in the Oregon National Guard and from the people in Iraq by neither placing Oregon's men and women in a position to be killed or to kill for an immoral war, one that is being shown to have authorization on an ill-founded basis, could be one of the most gallant acts of your life, regardless of the impact on your career. Please listen, study, and learn, and consider with extreme care your role in carrying out justice for all, for the people of Oregon who depend on your courage and wisdom to act, for the people of our nation and the world watching, for the people of Iraq living in the horror of this war in their own homeland, and for the men and women of the Oregon National Guard.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the Rules Committee, I thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. My name is Peter Burgell. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Peace Works, which is a statewide peace and justice organization located here in Salem. Our organization is one of 56 or so which currently officially supports House Bill 2556 and House Resolution 4. Much of my prepared testimony, which you have before you, repeats what has already been said, so I won't go through it in detail. You're invited to read it if you haven't had enough already. But I do want to skip down to the part toward the end where it says that if these wars are not legal, which I think we have at least given you pause to consider it may be the case, then our state is colluding in an illegal occupation of another country by sending our National Guard to participate. And if we are violating the law, then we should cease doing so at once. If federal authorities will not enforce the Constitution in this case, then according to the spirit of the Nuremberg principles, which our country was key in developing, then we have an individual and a collective responsibility to act to prevent further violation of the law. And I think that is, in fact, the situation in which we find ourselves. An illegal war is proceeding, and it needs to be stopped because it violates our Constitution. And therefore, we call upon the members of this committee to send House Bill 2556 and House Resolution to the House floor with a due pass recommendation, and I thank you very much for your opportunity for the opportunity to bring you that message.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, thank you for having this hearing today. I very much appreciate it. My name is Dan Handelman. I'm with the group Peace and Justice Works. We're another one of the organizations working on the campaign to keep Oregon's Guard in Oregon. Before I proceed with my own comments, which I haven't written down, I just wanted to make sure that everybody got the 16-page analysis that came from Mr. Benson Scotch of Vermont. And Benson
yes.
Scotch, if you didn't read his introduction, he served on Senator Patrick Leahy's staff counsel on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he was staff attorney for the Vermont Supreme Court and executive director of the ACLU of Vermont. And Mr. Scotch was the author of the first of these bills that went forward in Vermont last year to keep the Guard from being deployed when there's no valid authorization. You've heard this already, but I'm going to reiterate. This campaign is now in 22 states in this union. Seven states have legislation that's already been introduced, including ours, and several other states are in the process of getting that legislation introduced. So we would not be alone if we passed this legislation with all these other states. And I think one of the things we've heard is a fear of retaliation for if Oregon were to do this, a fear that the federal government would somehow defund our Guard. But there is safety in numbers, and if we work as part of a national movement to reassert that states have the ability to decide whether or not a authorization is valid before accepting the presidential call-up, then we will indeed balance the Constitution, and I think our current president, being a constitutional scholar, would appreciate the states helping to define what the roles are of the National Guard for the states and for the federal government. So Mr. Scotch's analysis addresses a couple of other questions. I'm not going to go into the details here, but I hope you have time to read it, about the questions of whether by renewing the funding over and over again did Congress, in essence, renew the authorization for use of military force? And he answers the question, no, they did not, because, in fact, the last couple of times they tried to set withdrawal dates, and the president vetoed those bills. So they had to resubmit the bills again. So it's pretty clear that the Congress wanted to end the conflict, but the president continued it despite them. And related to that is that he makes a comment that the president might be able to continue sending the regular military into an area of conflict under his powers as a commander-in-chief, but the guard has to be authorized by a congressional act. And the point of H.R. 4 is that the congressional act for Iraq has expired. The two terms that Congress laid out have been met. And in terms of Afghanistan, the congressional law, resolution in 2001, said that the president can go to any country at any time and attack somebody as long as he says they had something to do with 9/11, which is really abdicating Congress's role as declarers of war to the president. And I don't want to live in a country where a king or the president has that overbroad power. So we're asking you to look very carefully at this, look at Mr. Scotch's analysis, and look at the bill and pass 2556 as amended and pass H.R. 4. And just to make it clear, again, this is not about refusing service because we don't like the war. This is about the governor taking a piece of paper that crosses his desk, examining it, and saying, I don't believe this authorization is valid, and I'm not going to put the men and women of our state at risk without a legal authorization. And I hope that you will see fit to pass these on for vote on the House floor.
Thank you. Any questions for the witnesses? Thank you very much.
Chair Roblin,
yes.
If I may, I neglected to testify on HGM 5.
Oh, that's great.
If
please
I could
do
make
it
a couple
now.
Of comments about that.
Yep.
Again, Peter Brugel, Executive Director of Oregon Peace Works. We support, Oregon Peace Works supports passage of HJM 5, but not as a substitute for HB 2556 or HR 4. We believe these bills have the teeth to enforce the law, at least as regards Oregon's participation in illegal wars. And I think it should be the task of Congress to prevent the continuation of these illegal wars, either by ending them or by providing proper authorization for them. And for this reason, Oregon Peace Works supports sending Congress a direct message, as well as the indirect, but I think much stronger, message that would be sent by the passage of House Bill 2556 and H.R. 4. So we urge the committee to reject the easy out of passing H.J.M. 5 instead of H.B. 2556 and H.R. 4, but instead we ask the committee to pass all three. And so, thank you very much.
Thank you for that testimony. Next, we have Megan Brooker, Diane Stafford, and Curtis, is it Bell?
Hi, my name is Megan Brooker. I'd also like to thank the committee for having this hearing today. I'm a member of Military Family Speak Out. My brother is just finishing his second 12-month tour in Iraq with the U.S. Army. And I wanted to speak to you briefly about the best way that we can go about supporting the troops. We've heard this notion in the Oregonian article and other places that we're somehow letting down the troops, letting down the guard, disrespecting them if we ask for them not to go. This, to me, is illogical in the first place. What we need to remember is that the troops in the military, the troops in the Guard, don't decide if they will get deployed or not. They trust that their leaders in the country, those who control the military, that being the president for the armed forces or the governors for the National Guard, they trust that these people make the right decisions and only deploy them to places if it's absolutely necessary for the best of the country. So it's our responsibility as citizens in a representative democracy to voice our opinions to our leaders on what should be happening in our country's policies. We must use our voices for these troops who cannot, and we must ensure that the best decisions are made on their behalf. So it's your job as representatives of the state of Oregon to decide whether it's legal, whether it's constitutional, and whether it's just for our Guard to be deployed to Iraq. We have to remember, though, that even though the troops don't have a voice in this matter, they do have opinions. We saw from veteran Benji Lewis earlier that there are veterans speaking out against this. The group Iraq Veterans Against the War is growing every day, and veterans are telling us that we don't belong there. The last poll of troops was a Zogby poll in February 2006. That poll showed that 72% of troops surveyed thought we should be out of Iraq within 1 year. That was 3 years ago. Of those, 29% said we should be out immediately. Can we wait 3 more years to continue to fail our troops? The troops know that success, however defined, is not possible in Iraq. Active duty troops don't belong there, let alone the Guard, who were never designed to be there in the first place. So I'm telling you today that the best way to support the troops is to pass HB 2556 and HR 4. We've heard from other testifiers today about the terrible effects on veterans and their families by deployments. We've heard from legal experts that the deployment of the National Guard is not constitutional and it's not legal. But we also have to remember that it's not in the best interest of Oregon. A fact that many people don't know is that the Louisiana National Guard was actually deployed to Iraq when Hurricane Katrina hit. And so Louisiana had to call in the Mississippi National Guard to help respond to that hurricane, to that disaster. That was one of the several reasons why it was such a slow and devastating response after Hurricane Katrina. We don't want that to happen to Oregon. We need the Guard here in the event of a national or a state emergency like they were designed to perform their duties. So in conclusion, as a representative of military families, I want to say again that the best way to support the troops is not to deploy them, especially the Guard, who does not belong there. So let's keep them home. Let's keep them safe. Let's pass these bills and do what's right, do what's just, and do what's constitutional. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you also. Thank you very much for this hearing and for giving a listen to this important issue. My name is Curtis Bell. I'm a member of PDX Peace Coalition in Portland, retired scientist. My brother was killed in Vietnam. My brother-in-law was killed in Korea. My father was badly wounded in the First World War, so our family has been touched by war. I just want to summarize very briefly what I see happening. It seems to me that HB 2556 is almost unobjectionable, that it's a restatement of existing law regarding control over the Guard and of the Constitution. The debate might arise over HR 4. And it seems to me that it's quite clear that these authorizations are either no longer valid or are unlawful. Take first the authorization for the use of military force in Afghanistan. It states that the president will have the authority to attack any person, group, or country that, in his opinion only, had anything to do with 9/11 or with terrorism. This is a unending authorization for constant federalization of the Guard, which seems to me contrary to how the Constitution saw the Guard should be controlled, and to all of our understanding that the Guard should be an emergency reserve and not indefinitely deployed as a branch of the regular army. And then to take to take the authorization for war in Iraq, it seems to me that this too is no longer valid, that it was had two purposes and two purposes only, very clearly stated by Congress, that the use of the force should be used for removing the threat that the regime of Saddam Hussein posed to the United States. And that threat may not have been there at first, but it certainly isn't there now. And the second purpose was to enforce all the relevant United Nations resolutions, and all of those resolutions had to do with the regime of Saddam Hussein, so they are no longer relevant. And so I urge you to allow this legislation to be voted on by the House. We've all heard here of the hardships that the Guard that going of the Guard causes for them, for their families, for their communities, for Oregon, both in their leaving and their possible loss and on their return. And I think the least that we can do is to be sure that the going of the Guard is lawful and in accord with the U.S. Constitution. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. Mike Sullivan. And I should also state, is there anyone else who would like to speak to any of these three bills? That's HB 2556, HR 4, HJM 5. We've gone through all the listed people. Okay. If you want to take your seat, you can come up too. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and the Rules Committee. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I live in Yamhill County. You see me by day as a lobbyist for AWPPW, but I am here in this arena as a private citizen. I am a veteran. I am disabled by a medical problem. I am in support of both all three, House Joint Memorial 5, House Resolution 4, and HB 2556. Although I didn't serve on the soil of Vietnam, I served on two aircraft carriers, which an area the size of football fields with 109 people. So although nobody shot at us, we saw plenty of action, lots of it. I had personal friends, good friends, who died and classmates in Vietnam, and that still is with me today. I had one friend who joined the Green Beret, and he went in retaliation for a friend of ours who had died in Vietnam. I had another close friend who took the other track. And if you were in the Navy, there were eight assignments you could get in boot camp, or choices you could pick. And if you picked the corpsman in any order of that, you got it. And he fell in love with a woman and decided that he would put pressure on his arm with a chair to the point he was disabled and he couldn't go to Vietnam. He defected, basically. So the war was all over the place, like this war is currently. And I, like others, could make the case that war is really class war, and I take that from the position of my education in labor history. When I was at the University of Massachusetts Amherst in graduate work, this was in February of 2003, on the eve of the invasion of March 20th, 2003, there was a professor who was part of an organization called Parents Against the War in Iraq. Hadn't even came yet. And there were 40 union students that were all union members. It was a union master's program. So I became an ally of hers, and we had a caucus. And it took us about 2.5 hours to convince the other classmates to go with a resolution to ask the AFL-CIO to oppose the upcoming war. Why is this important? Because in the history of organized labor, they had never supported a war until World War I. And this was because Samuel Gompers of the AFL wanted to legitimize unions because they were constantly under attack. He first went to the Republican Party with his 13 grievances, and they turned him down. So he went to Woodrow Wilson, who supported it as long as the AFL would support his war. And so that's how it came lockstep between labor and the Democratic Party, if you will, and war. It wasn't until Vietnam that the schism came again, and it was Walter Reuther, who was then the president of the UAW, and it was the pressure of his one daughter that helped cause him to pull the United Auto Workers of America out of the AFL-CIO in protest of Vietnam. So, you know, it's again, over and over again, we have the same cycle of class war. My belief is that if you took the top 1% richest families in this country and had a draft today, we wouldn't all be here today debating this issue. There is a book that I must suggest for everybody in this room, and it's by Maxine Wong, and it's called Veterans of War, Veterans of Peace. and it's prose, poetry, and short stories of people that have experienced war and extreme violence. I would like to close, though, tongue-in-cheek, in a humorous note, to say that if I was the current governor of this state, I'd bring all the troops back home where they belong here in Oregon. Give them 30 days leave, and you'll enjoy this, Chair Roblin. I'd send them off to the federal forest, to thin the forest and make them healthy. And then I would sue for peace against the federal government, and we probably would get more stimulus money that way. Thank you.
Thank you. Please identify yourself because you're on the list.
My name is Jim Lamison. I'm a journalist. My intention today wasn't to testify, but I've been working on a series of magazine articles and a book about returning soldiers for the last 2 years. And one of the things that I've learned from interviewing dozens and dozens of Pacific Northwest soldiers is that every soldier almost by definition becomes a casualty of war. And whether they're disfigured physical injuries or medium to serious post-traumatic stress, every soldier that I've talked to, whether they were injured, still pro-mission soldiers, soldiers who are on their way back to Iraq, and soldiers who have come around and become veterans against the war, they all have been profoundly affected. And post-traumatic stress is the human natural response to war. It's what happens to you if you have feelings and if you are a human being. And so it's not a disorder. One of the most important things that I think that this committee ought to consider is the financial impact of caring for the soldiers when they come back. As we send 3,000 to 3,500 more Oregonians to war, expect about that many to come back and need help. And that the cost of that to the Oregon taxpayers, which I'm sure we will all gratefully do for them, is going to be in the tens or maybe hundreds of millions of dollars over the next 10, 20, 50 years of those soldiers' lives, their families' lives, and their communities' need for support for those great soldiers that we send there. So thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you for having us here. I'm going to start off by letting you know who I am.
Perfect.
So, got me. I'm on top of it. Thanks.
That was good.
I already caught your cue. My name's Chris Henry. I am the Portland Metro Chapter Chair and Executive Director of the Pacific Green Party of Oregon, the Portland Metro Chapter. I'm also a Teamster. I've been on layoff for about a week now. The economy's pretty tough. I'm questioning the logic behind being in other countries and having military adventures abroad while our states are failing one by one by one by two. It's wreaking havoc on budgets. I know that you're probably having difficulty trying to come up with funds to pay for programs that have scarce budgets. Money is probably nascent at best to try to come up with. I came to the Green Party because I had a nephew who said, "Uncle Chris, I think you're in the wrong party. I think with your values and everything, you should look at the Greens." I went into the party and started looking at it, and it did jibe with my values. My nephew, only a few months later, enlisted in the Guard and went to Iraq. He served a term or a tour in Iraq and came back. His duty wasn't that difficult. He was on a base most of the time doing guard duty. He's been back for about a year now, and he's about ready to ship out again to do a second tour. I met him at the airport, and my nephew had a connection that most soldiers, most people in a uniform do have. He has a connection with the people that he's with, a very close bonding connection, And that's what he's looking for, is to find a bond, to form a bond with people that have camaraderie. I'm not so sure, you know, watching him walk throughout the airport and he was greeted by people just from out of nowhere coming up and shaking his hand, thanking him. I think the gratitude is splendid. I understand what they're doing. They understand what they're doing as well. Many of them understand that they've been in a war under false pretenses, that the mission has changed many times, and they understand that they enlisted at the onset to actually go in for school money and to sort of fast track, almost like it's a scholarship program for the poor to get into school. He enjoys when people come up to him and talk to him and thank him. He can gain that same camaraderie in other programs as well. But he has this connection. I understand his connection. I'm not rejecting that. But I see that we have a responsibility to make sure that when our guard do go overseas, when they do go on a mission, when they go somewhere else, that we send them only when it's legally within their rights. And right now, I'm not so sure that we are watching out for them as we should. So if there's no war declared, if there's no reason to have them abroad, then we should have them home. We should do everything in our power to bring them home. I want to qualify my remarks a little further. This last November, I ran for Congress against David Wu. I ran with three other individuals. What was interesting is I went to a Willamette Week interview, and when I attended this interview, all of us could agree on one common thing. Well, a couple. One was global warming, and another was the war. And I would like to connect those two for you. And I think we should be looking at this seriously, because while we're going to war for oil, while we're over there in other countries where we shouldn't be, where they have no capability of harming us from where they are, it wasn't a country that attacked us. It's costing us a lot in fossil fuels in order to do this. And I think we should be thinking about the global warming aspect and start connecting global warming with global warming. And that should be weighing on us heavily as we send people out on military adventures. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to these three? We have one more bill that we're going to try to get to, but we have one more person who didn't sign up. Thanks.
My name is George Hutchinson. I'm from Corvallis. Representative Gelser, I told you I would be here. I said I probably wouldn't testify, and I'm barely going to. I signed up for over there on that sheet,
seven.
And it turns out that's for the other bill, which I'm definitely in support of.
Okay.
Gentlemen and ladies, you've heard some of the most articulate people that I've listened to in a long time, and I hope you found them that way also. And in most of them were speaking from the heart. We did have a few lawyers here who spoke from the logical mental aspect of this bill. And I want to read just the proposed amendment, which I'm truly impressed that Representative Erickson has supported this and said the following. As used in this section, organized militia means the Oregon Army National Guard and the Oregon Air National Guard. Two, the organized militia is limited to service on behalf of the state of Oregon unless the organized militia is called into federal service pursuant to a valid congressional enactment consistent with the United States Constitution. Gentlemen, ladies, that's your duty to pass this piece of legislation and the other two proposals that are in front of you. Thank you.
Thank you. If there's no one else, then we're going to close the hearing on HJM 5, HJR 4, and House Bill 2556. And then we're going to open a hearing on HJM 7. And we'll give a short explanation.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, HJM 7 urges Congress to shift funds from the federal defense budget to the states. The federal government mandates that the states undertake, manage, or implement certain programs, but does not provide sufficient funding to pay the full cost of all of those programs. Proponents assert that such unfunded mandates shift costs from the federal government to state government. In 1995, Congress enacted the Unfunded Mandates Reform Act. Under the law, under the UMRA, the Congressional Budget Office is required to conduct cost estimates of bills approved by authorizing committees in Congress. Out of 3,059 bills analyzed by the Congressional Budget Office between 1996 and 2000, 355, or roughly 12%, contained intergovernmental mandates or mandates on state and local governments, and 32, or roughly 1%, included mandates for costs that exceeded $50 million, which is a threshold figure used in the Act. Proponents further assert that the United States military expenditures are almost half of the combined military expenditures of all the world's nations, and that the United States military expenditures have been repeatedly shown to generate less economic benefits than any other form of economic activity. The Congressional Budget Office indicates that approximately 20% of the fiscal year 2008 federal budget was spent on national defense. There are other sources of budgetary information that assert higher total military outlays. HJM 7 urges Congress to enact legislation that shifts funds from the defense budget to the several states to assist those states in meeting the increased cost of responsibility for federal programs that have been shifted to the states.
Thank you very much. And we have a few people. We'll probably go a little over five. We have permission to do that. And that's generally when this one gets over. So if members have other commitments, they may have to leave, but I will stay here for sure. So with that, is it Peter? Is it Burgell? And Karis Klein?
Craig.
I'm sorry. I didn't see the G. Thanks, Craig. And Chris Eckstein. Oh, Craig, there you go. Now I got the G. And thank
Once
you for
again,
being
Mr.
here.
Mr. Chair, members of the Rules Committee, my name is Peter Burgell, Executive Director of Oregon Peace Works, statewide peace, justice, and environmental organization. We requested that this bill be introduced because we have believed for many years that our federal government is spending excessively on the military and consequently starving the real needs of the people of this country. With the advent of large unfunded federal mandates, the problem has significantly worsened. In today's economic climate, we can no longer afford, if we ever could, to allow this misallocation of resources to continue. In the name of national security, ladies and gentlemen, we must insist that the economic security of our people here at home be weighted more heavily and the funding of the military less heavily, lest we find that we have become a starving ruin inside an invincible suit of armor. So I just wanted to review the facts were asserted in the whereas clauses of the message to Congress that is being proposed here in HJM 7. The first three, I think, are self-evident and well-known to the members of the committee, so I'll not touch on those. The fourth, that the four countries identified as state sponsors of terrorism by the United States have a combined defense budget far less than the approximately $730 billion defense budget of the United States is easy to demonstrate. Those four countries are Iran, Cuba, Sudan, and Syria, according to the official designation of the U.S. Secretary of State's office. Their military budgets are, as you see there on the testimony, approximately 1%. Mr. Watson indicated that the Congressional Budget Office provided certain figures as to the defense budget. Having been a person who's looked at the defense budget for many years, I know that it's possible to come up with a defense budget that's practically any number that you want to choose. It begins, as Fred Kaplan, who has researched the defense budget also, it begins with $515 billion for the Pentagon. Then there's $16 billion for nuclear warhead and reactor activities in the Department of Energy, $5.2 billion for defense-related activities in other agencies like the FBI, $4.3 billion for military health care and retirement, $70 billion in new supplemental requests for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and $102 billion in leftover supplemental requests from last year. That totals $713 billion, but doesn't include Homeland Security, veterans benefits, or the military portion of NASA, all of which are shown in a more thorough analysis, which I forgot to bring with me, but which I will get to the committee later, I'm sorry. But with those additions, the figure easily tops $1 trillion, or twice as much as we're generally told. But even using Kaplan's more conservative figures, the states which allegedly sponsor terrorism spend just about 1% of what we do on their military, and surely with almost everyone in the nation accepting major cuts at this time, and certainly you're all more than aware of that in the position that you sit, it's appropriate to ask the military to accept cuts as well. And indeed, U.S. Representative Barney Frank, Massachusetts, is currently proposing a 25% cut in the military's budget. And the Frank cuts would be achieved by timely withdrawal from Iraq, for one thing, and by cutting wasteful weapon systems and programs, which he enumerates and which I can also provide to the committee if you're interested. The next assertion is that the United States military expenditures are almost half of the combined military expenditures of all the world's nations. And again, we're using the conservative figures here. The world's military expenditures total approximately $1.5 trillion, and thus at the $730 billion figure that we're using as a kind of a mid-range, it's about that. It's about half of it, which is means that we're spending about what the whole rest of the world spends put together. I would expect that the assertion in the bill that Pentagon spending has been repeatedly shown to generate less economic benefit in terms of jobs and multiplier effects than any other form of economic activity would raise some eyebrows on the members of the committee, since it does run counter to the conventional wisdom that military spending creates jobs. Nevertheless, study after study on the economic stimulus of military spending has shown that while, of course, it is undeniable that spending on the military does create jobs, that is a fact, it creates fewer jobs than any equivalent expenditure of public money that you can pick, anyone. The most recent study to confirm this was released recently by the New America Foundation in February of this year by its director, William Hartung. In his summary of the study's finding, Hartung notes, and this is a quote, "It is interesting to note that military spending creates far fewer jobs, 8,555 per $1 billion spent, than any other form of public investment, be it health care, provides 12,883 jobs, or education, 17,687 jobs, mass transit, 19,795, or infrastructure and home weatherization, 12,000 804 jobs. That's the end of the quote. Hartung's findings have been echoed by studies that go back at least to the 1980s. Another example is a 2005 study conducted by the University of Amherst. I'll skip all the details on that. You can see them in my testimony there, but they produce the same findings, that no matter how you cut it, spending public money on the military creates fewer jobs than any other kind of spending of public money. So in conclusion, the memorial asserts that shifting federal funds from military spending to the states would dramatically improve the security of our citizens and strengthen our ability to compete successfully in the global marketplace. We believe that Americans are not being made safer by the current conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. In fact, we believe it is clear that the U.S. occupation of these countries has had the effect of creating more terrorists. And this was also the conclusion of terrorism experts who studied the matter at the Conservative Heritage Foundation in 2007. And I give you a quote there, or a citation there, if you want to look at that study. We also believe that the stockpiling and deployment of nuclear weapons around the globe does not do anything to make us safer either. And our view there is backed by a poll conducted in South Carolina in 2007, and this is in South Carolina, which is a fairly conservative state, where two-thirds of the likely voters wanted the United States to lead the world in reducing the number of nuclear weapons globally, and they believed that those reductions would make the United States safer. So again, cutting the funding for those kinds of expenditures would make us safer, not less safe. Likewise, maintaining our current network of about 1,000 foreign military bases, 1,000 foreign military bases all over the world adds little or nothing to the security of Americans at home. I think our citizens are much more threatened by economic factors in the short run, as we're seeing in the current crisis, and by environmental degradation and the infrastructure collapse in the longer run than by terrorism or by foreign attack. To put these threats in perspective, just for one single small example, relatively small example, 3,000 Americans died 7 years ago during the 9/11 attacks. But 60,000 Americans die every year, just from the environmental consequences of burning coal to make electricity. So you see, there's different magnitudes of threats that we need to look at. And I think national security requires that we do look at these threats. So it is essential that we direct more of our public dollars to the real needs of our citizens. And this message to Congress, that is HJM 7, requests just that. Will the Congress listen? We don't know. But our democracy is based on the premises that our representatives will listen to their constituents. And if we don't use that system, then we can't be surprised if it doesn't work. So on behalf of the members of Oregon Peaceworks, and in the interests of the citizens of the state of Oregon, as well as the rest of the country, I urge the committee to vote out HJM 7 with a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Craig, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, members of the committee. My name is Craig Klein. I'm just a citizen. I have the good fortune, however, to be within the district represented by Representative Berger, and I say that just because I'm appreciative of the fact she took her personal time to meet with me on this subject and encouraged me to get involved, and I felt that to be good advice, and I did, and so here I am, and I'll try to be brief with these remarks, but I think they're very important, and I want to personalize them to Oregon. I wrote the testimony and entitled it, Where's the Money? In a guest opinion of the Statesman Journal appearing on February 22, 2009, Governor Kulongoski stated that our economy, and I quote, our economy remains volatile and revenues for important public services continue to decline, affecting the current 2007-2009 budget and 2009-2011 biennium, unquote. He said that, quote, we will have to make reductions to core services, unquote. Senate President Peter Courtney has said that the projected 2009-11 gap between income and spending is already at $3 billion and could grow to $5 billion. The governor's and President Courtney's concerns, Oregon's concerns, are mirrored by virtually every state in our United States. Collectively, we citizens and our political leaders are asking, where's the money that we need to properly function as stronger states in our presently weakened union? House Joint Memorial 7 speaks to what is an enormous federal problem that severely afflicts the states. The memorial was spawned from a joint Senate resolution written for the state of Vermont in 1997. The resolution stated then that the U.S. military budget for 1997 is $265 billion. According to information gathered by Oregon Peaceworks Organization, which Peter just presented, the defense budget of the United States is now approximately $730 billion, and arguably it could be a trillion. I mean, you can come up with numbers higher than that. That represents $730 billion, a 175% increase in the Department of Defense, DOD, budget in only 12 years, an average of close to 15% per year. I personally believe that America is, will continue to be, the mightiest military power that the world will ever know. The DOD's budget reflects that reality. However, it's also a reality that as ever more of our tax dollars have been absorbed by the DOD, an ever fewer number of dollars are available for our common defense. Consider the vitally important words of the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. I submit to you that we, the people, with the assistance of our state legislators, must take action to make these words truly come to life, most especially our absolute need to provide for the common defense. Our common defense should, by the Constitution's intent made current, provide that we defend our states against disintegration from within. We disintegrate from within when we are unable to adequately fund our important public services, our core services that Governor Kulongoski spoke of. In House Joint Memorial 7 lies a potential solution to this dilemma. It asks that Oregon and all of the states receive funding from, in effect, the nation's defense budget. If each of the states were allocated 1/50th of only a 7% portion of the $730 billion in DOD dollars, each would receive over $1 billion, which is $1,000 million, to use towards serving their citizens' domestic needs. I realize this is simplistic math. It's easier said than done. However, if nothing is said, nothing will change, and our own precious tax dollars will continue to overfund the DOD budget while underfunding our own state budgets. What's especially troubling about the massive expenditures of the DOD is that so much of our money is so terribly wasted. And when that waste extends to years and years of funding the unnecessary and unjustifiable war in Iraq, our nation's loss, our entire nation's loss, and indirectly our own state of Oregon's loss, is made even worse, billions upon billions of dollars worse. Isn't it interesting that we citizens are forced to scrutinize our city, county, state, and school budgets to try to eliminate every last nickel of waste and unnecessary spending, while we ignore how our tax dollars are so voraciously consumed by the DOD? It's heartening to note that Congressman Barney Frank, chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, recently proposed that Congress cut 25% from the military budget. Yes, he suggests 25%. He noted that it is precisely here where, quote, our spending has been the most irresponsible and produced the least good for the dollars expended. He was joined by military reform experts who made a case for a military budget based not on political power or DOD wish lists, but instead based on strategy and real defense needs. Don't you agree that real defense needs should also include defending and therefore funding our domestic needs, starting right here at home across the towns and cities of this state? The money for those needs, our tax dollars, could come from the DOD budget, but we must ask and indeed demand that domestic needs be funded as part of a more comprehensive national defense strategy. I realize this memorial is symbolic, it's without force of law. However, the time for this type of message to be given to Congress is now. In fact, it's been long, long overdue. Congressman Frank is clearly stating the obvious and is seeking citizen support for his proposal. Let Oregon be the first state to formally join him in this all-important effort to redirect defense spending for benefit of all of our 50 states. We the people respectfully seek your legislative support of this memorial. We hope that it paves the way for all of the other 49 states to join the great state of Oregon in this mission. We must defend ourselves against the dreaded disintegration from within that we are presently experiencing. Legislators, I join Oregon Peaceworks in asking that you give your personal support to the message contained in HJM 7. Let's do it in honor of Senator Mark Hatfield, who would, no doubt, be very pleased with this memorial. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Christopher Eckstein. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, as elected representatives of the citizens of the state of Oregon, you're faced with the difficult task of closing the gap between inadequate state revenue and the amount needed to fulfill the basic needs of the citizens of the state of Oregon. I'm a substitute teacher for the Portland Public Schools, so I get a chance to see conditions in a variety of neighborhoods in the city of Portland. And unfortunately, I witness many students whose basic needs are not being met. And this comes before our current budget shortfall and budget cuts that we expect to be coming. So these include inadequate facilities, large classes, supplies that students don't have, and students with special needs that are not being met. And I don't see how a cut in the budget will result in anything other than a decline in the quality of education that these students deserve. Of course, so I know you're looking for ways to increase revenue to help close this deficit. HJM 7 asks for increase in funding from the federal government such that we can hopefully meet the needs of the citizens of Oregon. So I think you probably could all agree that we need more money. The question then is, where should this money come from? In solving our problems, we need to practice good governance, and in doing so, we need to examine the programs that we have and determine which ones we're spending too much money on. As Peter said, the U.S. military budget is about equal to that of the rest of the world combined. So the threat that we are preparing ourselves for, it has nowhere near the capabilities that we have. And, of course, we must remember that most of the other countries that are spending significant sums of money are our allies or countries that we are on very close terms with. So as if we look at it critically, a large military budget is very hard to defend. Of course, it's a very easy political statement to make to argue for greater military spending and a strong military. But if we examine the facts and the threats that we're faced with, it becomes a hard argument to make. Of course, our military is designed to combat a threat that no longer exists. We've continued the path of funding a military to combat the Soviet Union, and as the world climate has changed, we have continued the policies of our predecessors, but it's our duty to re-examine the money we're spending, and as we're faced with other needs to move it to more pressing concerns. HGM 7 is a chance for the state of Oregon to make a statement to the federal government to rethink our national priorities and transfer resources that we're wasting on the weapons of the past to help Oregon and the states use the funds so they can be best put to use. I urge you to support HGM 7.
Thank you, all of you. And I did want to say, I think Representative Bailey, you were some of the comments you were said for him as well. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. He left me a note indicating that. Thank you, all three. Curtis Bell, Chris, is it Herring or Henning?
Henry.
Oh, there we go, Henry. And George Hutchinson, if they're still here.
George is left.
Okay.
It appears Curtis might have left.
Yeah, it might have, so it looks like you are. Yeah, unless there's anyone else that would like to speak to this bill at this time. Okay.
Okay. I'm speaking in favor of HGM 7, and I did an interesting thing before I came in. I went to a site that I was using during my congressional campaign before November, and it's called nationalpriorities.org. And I typed in roughly what my annual income was, and it computed rough figures for taxes. There's also a formula for how they came about this, and it states how much I would have spent in the last 5 years on the Iraq War alone, and that came out to $9,971. That's a per-person cost, and I figured that at $42,000 a year on income. I make slightly a bit more. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but if you go to War Resisters League, you can get the pie chart that they put out annually that expresses how much is spent on the military budget. My grandfather was a speechwriter for President Eisenhower. He was his personal secretary when he was General Eisenhower. And there's one speech in particular that I used during my campaign, and I wouldn't mind giving you a few of the pointers to it. I'm sure you've heard this before, but I'll just give it, I'll be brief, and it says, the worst we have to fear and the best to be expected can be simply stated. The worst is atomic war. The best would be this, a life of perpetual fear and tension, a burden of arms draining the wealth and the labor of all people, a wasting of strength that defies the American system. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies, in a final sense, a theft from those who hunger and who are not fed, from those who are cold and who are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It's spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this, a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electrical power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. I agree with Chris Eckstein that we have had the Cold War going on for a long time, and we've been paying for wars past, present, and future. And this is ongoing. And I think we have a responsibility to look over these budgets and reevaluate them. I was an electrical mechanic on the B-1 bomber in the 80s during Gulf War I, and a civilian electrical mechanic. There are other ways that we can provide for people to do things instead of just working for war. We're looking at a green economy. I think a lot of our funding will be shifting there, and we're going to need to shift our priorities. I think the HGM 7 will go a long way toward making that gesture to the federal government that the states need those resources home. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that I'll ask one more time before I close the hearing? Then we're going to close our hearing on HJM 7. Committee, that's pretty much it. I certainly appreciate people staying this long for this whole thing, and I thank you for that. We do not have a meeting on the 13th. Had a bunch of bills listed there, and all their sponsors came and asked if we could please take it off. Friday the 13th was not when they wanted us to fill their bills, so we will not have a meeting on Friday. And with that, we will adjourn our rules meeting. Thank you.